Blog Talk Radio. Blog Talk Radio. Blog Talk Radio. Blog Talk Radio.
I don't know about you, but I am the black gold of the sun. I'm sure you are, too. If you're tuning in to this program as you are, yes, you are the black gold of the sun. Welcome to another edition of Progressive News Weekly. My name is Daryl Clark, and yes, you're at the right place at the right time. And I certainly, sincerely, truly thank you for taking the time out to tune in to another edition of Progressive News Weekly, where news is brought to you with sincerity and with integrity. It's news that's intended to encourage you, empower you, instill you to get involved and make a difference. You see, it's news that's intended to be used and not just sat upon or listened to. It's news where we encourage you truly to make a difference by being involved. This is truly grassroots radio. Week in and week out, we bring you this news and information that's gathered from around the country, typically, and on occasion from the waters or across the borders internationally. The topic, whatever it may be, is often, if not usually, supported by a special guest, which is well-versed in that subject matter. If you happen to have news or information, topics and the like, which you believe is not hitting the mainstream, because you see, that's what we're about. The information and news that you get here is not typically provided on mainstream. You may see or you may hear a topic that we bring you here on mainstream, but not to the extent. You see, we don't skew it, we don't spin it, we don't shake it. We bring it to you straight, no chaser. It's unadulterated. It's uninfluenced by business or political interest. And it's vetted in terms of the guests that we bring, which supports that news and information and or topic. And so with that said, if you, again, do know of such subject matter or personnel, please share it. You can reach out to me at Daryl, D-A-R-R-Y-L, underscore, C-L-A, 1-8, at msn.com, and I love to hear from you. Today, well, second day of February, and our first in a series of Black History programming. Of course, we don't limit ourselves to the month of February for Black History, I'm proud to say. But this is always an extra special month for Black History and Progressive News Weekly. As we approach our 10th year, this year and specifically this month, I'm excited about some of the guests and topics that we're going to be bringing to you. I know many of you have been asking about some of our previous regular guests, and let me just allay your concerns that the likes of Dr. Joy DeGruy, the likes of Dr. Jawanza Kanjufu, the likes of Mr. Dick Gregory, the likes of Akhil Kalfani will all be joining Progressive News in the not-too-distant future. They're all slated and, for the most part, booked. So look for your newsletter in the weeks ahead for those guests. But in addition to those special guests, we have a whole slew of additional guests that are new to Progressive News that I believe you'll find quite informative and quite moving. I like that word. It's an action word. And that's what we're about on Progressive News Weekly. Today, with no exception to what we do here week in and week out, I'm proud and pleased and, as they say, just plumb pleased and pickled over the guest today. You see, I love it when I have a guest who's a regular to some extent, and especially one who just comes right from the hip. You know, that bring it and sling it, that when you just, as the Wild Westerns used to do, just pull it up and cock that trigger and blam, bring it. No ready, aim, shoot. None of that revolutionary stuff when they used to march in lines. I never understood that. I guess it's just patriotism or the like. I won't use any other words for the sensitivities out there. But they just would stand in line, and the ones in the front always got it first. You know, it's just, woo. But it was just the idea that they would just march, and then you wouldn't fire till you see the whites of their eyes. You know, well, that's a saying, not necessarily the case. But in this case, for sure, our guest, and yes, I'm stretching it out as I do, he doesn't mince words. And he's going to talk about, so apropos that this is our first African-American History Month programming week for 2017. He's well-versed in history. In fact, he's our resident historian, I like to refer to him as. I like to refer to him, and I'm just stretching it out, as Dr. Crenshaw. That's right. We have Mr. Ronald Crenshaw joining us again. For those of you who are new, and I'm pleased and proud to say that very few weeks we don't have new listeners, and again, I'm just pleased and proud to say that, and welcome to our new listeners for this evening. Please share if you like what you hear, and if you don't like what you hear, maybe someone else will. Still share it. And so, for those of you who are not familiar with our special guest, Mr. Ronald Crenshaw, you need to understand that this man has been bringing news unadulterated, straight, researched for over three decades. And he's respected on civil rights, political journalism, and history. And so, Mr. Ronald Crenshaw this evening, and we had a few conversations about this, is going to bring you an enlightenment on African-American history, I believe in a way that you may not have heard before, especially if you're new to Progressive News Weekly. And if you're not, it's like a really, really excellent movie. I've not seen an excellent movie ever. That's an encompassing word, ever, where the second time I saw it, I didn't see something that I didn't catch in previous viewings. I've never, ever seen an excellent movie. And I say that because Mr. Crenshaw is like an excellent movie. You may have heard him before, but you're guaranteed in subsequent listenings to hear something that you didn't catch before. A little bit about Ron. He is a historian, a political activist, research analyst. But all of that aside, and he's very humble about his acumen, he's a crusader for equal and human rights, not just rights for African Americans, as he'll tell you in a drop of a hat. because we're all in this pathway to truth and justice and enlightenment. But he does have an affinity for African Americans. And so through his well-researched and derived insight to the insights, I mean, derived insight to the issues that impact our society, tonight, as always, he's going to provide some provocative information that's not typically heard on mainstream as it relates to history. And we're going to give him as much time as we need to from what he has for us. And if we run out of time, then we'll come back and continue, because we don't cut our programs short. You won't hear something like you do on the mainstream media, the three major networks or the other cable networks, where you get a topic. It could be something as interesting as alien life, and you'll get a half an hour program and say, wait a minute, they found alien life and all we get is 30 minutes? Can we get a little bit more, please? So no, we'll run this series as long as we have to. Ron's inspiration for his body of work stems from the work of notables such as Paul Robeson and other great African Americans. Tonight, in this enlightening, riveting interview, make sure you got your seatbelts on. He's going to share the history of African Americans from a perspective of the African diaspora, timelines, critical points in African American history. And then he's going to reflect on some of his special favorites in terms of those notables. So without further ado, my true pleasure to bring to the airwaves Derano Crenshaw. Ron, welcome to another edition of Progressive News Weekly.
Thanks. Thank you very much for inviting me. I appreciate the privilege to give my effort of explaining things about our history as African Americans. I'll try to live up to the accolades that you placed upon me with all due effort, believe me. And I say that because I know I'm not perfect in any sense of the word, but I am sincere to the fact of trying to reach out and get an understanding of the complexity that we live in. That's my heartfelt voyage to try to do, is to find out how we can, you know, what are the things that are the boundaries that are in our way, and why are things the way they are, to the best of my ability. That's where I'm at. So I guess we will start with how the African diaspora got started, and I take it that's where I think I should start. So if we try to get to that, we will find that first of all, there was the awakening of Europe. That came slowly, and after the fall of Rome, there were several centuries of what they call in Europe the Dark Ages. And, of course, from that, the collapse of Rome and all of its established authority and rule over most of Northern Europe. Rome had conquered Spain, France, Germany, and England. So that fell because they were extinguishing themselves so far until it just collapsed. They couldn't support where they were going. But anyway, this is not a discussion on Europe, but it's tied in because we are one species of humans, and that's the important note that I want to give throughout all of my message, is that we are one species, and we have to find out how we can bring this all together. So therefore, the collapse of Rome, then the rise of Islam. And it is the rise of Islam where they, Arabs, penetrate into into Africa, and also parts of Europe too. But it is from the Arabs that start the slave trade with Africans, and because their civilization has developed further than anyone else. So as this happens, Spain and Portugal start trading off the African coast and find that the Arabs are dealing in slavery, and slavery of Africans. So this gives them the note of what to do and how to bring their newfound Western Hemisphere into their orbit, because as they find it, it's a very green and luscious land that has not been, you know, kind of like industrialized or anything like that, built up by the people that were there, which are primarily Indians. They're called Indians, but that's not what they really are. Anyway, that's where Columbus gets his idea, that because he was seeking a way to go to India. So he thought when he got to, this is 1492, when he got to the New World, so to speak, which was the Caribbean area, he saw these brown people, so he called them Indians, and that seems to have stuck because, you know, they had different names than that, and there were different groupings of brown-skinned people. So, but they had, you know, other phenotypes that were different and all of that, but that's not what they went into. So the idea was that they tried to subjugate the people in the Caribbean, but because they were knowledgeable of their land and the land mass, they could be captured, but they would run away. And it was hard to keep up with trying to keep them in one place. So when the information between the Arabs and the Europeans realized that what they could do was get Africans and bring them to the New World, and that would start, it would put them on a land base that they were not familiar with, and they would have better control. So actually, what happens is that the Africans come into the New World, and they are treated as indentured servants at first, at least in, let me say, in particular, in North America, which is the first landing in North America is 1619 in Jamestown, Virginia. So as things go forward, eventually the treatment of the people, the Europeans as well, because they're indentured, and the early Africans are indentured. However, the two of them get together to throw off the oppression of the leadership of Britain. So this happens in 1676. And 1676, and it's Nathaniel, let's see, I'm trying to think of his last name. Shucks, why can't, oh, let's see, he was Bacon, that's his last name, Nathaniel Bacon. And the governor is able to get away before he can be caught, and so he goes back to England, and then by 1677, Bacon, when he gets back with troops, Bacon has died from some sort of illness. So it was with the British troops, they are able to overthrow the revolt. And so they get together, with they come together themselves and decide to make a separation of blacks and whites so that they don't. And with this idea, they decide to put in chattel, meaning owning a person can own an African and his whole family, which is a little different. He has no rights other than the rights that the master wants to give to him. So this is not something new. This was something used by the Romans and the Greeks. So people seem to think that this is the first place that chattel slavery ever existed. But no, it was used in the ancient world. And that's probably where these sources come from. Anyway.
Ron, can I stop for just a moment?
Yes.
Yeah, you mentioned that African Americans actually came here as indentured servants?
Yes, yes. Of course, again, that's not, you know, that's not recognized either. You see, yeah, initially they were indentured servants. But
not
since
slaves.
since they were able to see that they would come together with white indentured, they had the same conditions with working for one is working for the other. So that brings them together. See, so when they're both getting oppressed in the same way, they don't think of race because, see, the white race comes about in the new world. When they're in Europe, they're not considered white. They're considered either British, French, German, Spanish, Portuguese, but they're not considered white because they're used to everyone being white. See what I mean? So that wasn't a thing that was developed at that point. But at the point when they come to the new world, that becomes important because that's a way to divide, segment them, divide them, give the whites more privilege or privilege over the blacks, and you won't have a unity. So that's the thing that develops. That's how race develops, and that's how racism develops. Because you need that segmentation so that the people are at odds with each other. One feels superior to the other. You see, there's nothing, I mean, no, if you have one species, you don't have a superiority of one of the other, but it can act that way if one is able to conquer the other. You see, that's how you get these segmentations. One group is able to conquer the other, you see. So that's how it comes about, because England and Spain used to fight, and because Spain was, the first real rise of a nation after the fall of Rome. And then, of course, Britain meets on the sea and is able to, to win over Spain. They destroy its armada, as they call it, with, you know, tactical tricks that they do. So that's how one gets the hegemony over the other. But anyway, getting back to where we are, that's how that first starts. And, of course, we don't get information like that because they don't want people to know that there's been a time when blacks and whites were treated equally, because it doesn't serve the purpose, see, of keeping them segmented, and therefore one feeling better because one gets, you know, privileges over the other, you see. So have I answered you, or
you've clarified it very, very well, and and you know, I bring that point up because I think there are many that really did not understand that very important fact.
Yeah, right.
The time when many of the whites who came, and they were, as you said, identified not just by white, but by
their nationality,
yeah.
Their nation, you know, the area that they come from. That was that was the way it was.
And there was servitude. So I think that may, and I don't want to, you know, intervene, you know, to the point of distraction from your flow.
So
you did answer the question, and with that said, if you don't mind, Ron, can we open the airwaves? Though I have a feeling that everyone's riveted, and you probably won't get a question, but I like to let them know.
Sure.
You can wait after the fact,
sure.
But you can also press 1 on your dial if you have a pressing question, and we'll take your question in the background. The number is 347-838-9142, and you're listening to Mr. Ronald Crenshaw, historian and activist for human and equal rights, and a research analyst, and he's giving us a timeline and a history of the African-American diaspora, and he was at the point of, for those who I see just joined us, speaking about the fact that when Africans came in the early to mid-1600s, many came as an indentured service and not just the slaves, and to differentiate that, an indentured service, that's why I found that very profound. Indentured servant, help me with that as well. I understood that as a...
Go ahead. Well, that indentured servitude was a sort of like a price put on the head of a person, and they had to work it off, usually with seven years, as they brought people over. There weren't people in England that wanted to come, so they would go to the jailhouses and get them and put that tab on their head so that when they came over, in other words, they were making them pay for shipping them over to the New World. So they would ship a lot of them over, or they would juice them up in the taverns and things of that sort, get them drunk, and then put them on the ship to America. And they had a seven-year period of indentured servitude, and then they would be freed. But anyway, once they decided that they would put blacks in as chattel, then things started to really bloom and mushroom for the difference in wealth. Because, see, wealth comes from labor. So if you have someone working for you that you don't have to pay a salary, you just have to give them their upkeep, then you're getting bountiful amounts of income, because you can give them whatever they're just their necessities, and that's it. So it worked tremendously for the growth here in the Americas for the Industrial Revolution to come here. See, it starts in England, but and England really tries to keep a hold on their industrialization. They don't want the New World to people in the New World to understand and find out how the machinery worked. However, some of the Europeans that were over here went back and memorized the function of the machinery, and that's how it came back here. So it was this, in other words, the wealth was created through slave labor, and from the slave labor, it was able to catapult itself into the Industrial Revolution, because some people that, you know, got very rich from the chattel slavery. You are going to get rich from working people for nothing. So that's how America starts to get on its feet. It starts to get on its feet from chattel slavery, because that's all. Go ahead.
In the early 1700s, Ronald?
Yes. From the late 1600s, it starts. The chattel slavery starts, and the wealth starts to increase, you know, exponentially, because the rise of cotton, and the cash crops are the thing that they have here that they didn't have in Europe. The cotton, the rice. And it was Africans really that showed them how to develop with the rice, to grow the rice, and tobacco. Well, the Indians had tobacco, so they got that from the Indians. So the blacks were able to show them, you know, ways of doing these things. Many things came from Africa too. But, of course, they didn't give the Africans credit for it, because the thing was to keep the Africans from learning the English language. And, they had to learn the English language. I mean, write the English language. Write. That was the way they denied them to be able to read books. So if an owner was found allowing his slave to read a book, he would be prosecuted immediately. So that was important, to keep the African as ignorant as possible. And then you could say that he's subhuman, because he doesn't know your language, you see. So it was a thing where the ignorance was not really the African's fault. It was the fault of his oppression. So these things, develop, and that's how one conquers the other and go forward. So you have any question on that? Or?
Well, yeah, we're into the aspect of the chattel slavery, which was necessitated by the desire for wealth.
Right. They keep them separated so that they didn't revolt. If we had one suppressing the other, it would function better, because you have the whites over the blacks, and the blacks would, you know, give their labor for nothing. So the whites would just get, you know, minimum wage, of course, and they would work. But they would be given the authority over the blacks. In other words, the first starting of the police was to really chase after runaway slaves. That's how we get the development of the police system, to catch runaway slaves. So That's how that moves forward.
Now, as slavery became more prevalent, the white indentured slavery began to wane. Is that what happened?
Yeah.
It was just the chattel slavery.
They already had the 7 years. After the 7 years was up, then they would be just wage workers, wage laborers, as they say.
Oh, but with the Africans, they at that point were chattel slaves. That's
right.
When the laws became slaves.
Right. And then there was the racial laws that Africans couldn't do this or couldn't do that. And, you know, they had to get, if they had to go from one place to the next, they'd have to have a note from their master giving them the right to go somewhere, you know, off the plantation to get something and bring it back. So then the police would enforce that. Blacks on the road, and they would have to come up and show them their pass and things of that sort. So that's how that gets set up. And that's, you know, the way that the country starts to gather its wealth. And the North.
I was just going to lead that. How did that differentiation take place between the South and the North? That was going to be, so you're, go ahead. It sounded like you were going to lead into that.
Right, I was going to lead. Well, the North had a lot to do with also being a slave. They would have auctions in the North. Some of them would come from the South into the North, and they would have the auctions to send them to various locations southward, because Wall Street was a center for slaves to be brought in, and then they would be put on an auction block, and you know, the whole thing with bartering and I got this slave for $10 or $100, you know, it's fine, healthy, you know, male or female, that sort of thing. And from here, right into Massachusetts, Rhode Island, all of these places in the North also dealt with selling slaves. That's how Wall Street really develops in its with its stock market and stuff, as having this slave auctions done a lot. So
much of the trading took place in the North.
Yeah, a good bit of it was done in the North, right. But there was also larger importations being done in Charleston, South Carolina. That was one of the main imports, was Charleston, South Carolina was the biggest port. But they were also going into into New York and Boston and Rhode Island. They were also evidence there. That was, and that started to gather a lot of money for the North, getting wealth into the North also. So there was chattel slavery in the North for a while, but as the North started to industrialize, it became not profitable to maintain slavery, maintain chattel, because the day we live in wage slavery, so we have to be aware of the technicalities. We live in wage slavery because we go to a job and we're told exactly what to do by the boss. If we don't follow that, we look for another job. We'll have to. So we're in wage slavery, but that was the time of chattel. So that has divided now.
And that's where I was leading to, because history as it's commonly known, which is why we're having this dialogue, because we want to talk about the uncommon knowledge of history, is that many slaves migrated north. In fact, many of us in the north have a history. I have a history. I can trace back to some extent the travels, the trail of my, great ancestors, mine going to Mississippi. So, and I know many others can trace theirs back to South Carolina and Alabama and so forth. So with that transition north, leads to the thought that, well, the north were more, and I'm really cautious about this term, but I'll use it riskingly, were more liberal, and that's why those traveled north. Can you bring some light into that?
Well, one thing about the north is that the concept of insuring your slave, that's why the North, I think, gets more longevity, or should I say more power, because it becomes a center for having insurance policies built on the slaves. They make out an insurance policy on a slave so that when the slave dies, they'll get a certain amount of money, because they've, put money into the slave, into the bank, and they've made some kind of profit from the insurance. So that gets the North going with insurance policies. So I think that's one of the things that brings the North a little more incentive for this slave, slave market. So most of that is starting to be controlled by northern businessmen, you see. So, and also a lot of blacks that are in the middle of the country, like Maryland, and a lot of them get sent, are also purchased in Maryland and sent further south. So it's a thing where it's working, and it's bringing in, making money, because the cotton is being shipped to England, is starting to, make the cloth and making the clothing in England with the factories, you see. So England is getting, the South is sending their stuff to England, and as the as the Northerners start to learn how to make the machinery, that's why the North starts getting wealthy. Once they can set into and get the machinery going here, that's when the North starts getting getting wealthy, and getting wealthier than the South. So that starts the imbalance, because up until the point of past 1830s, or should I say, about after as the 1830s are going, the North is rapidly getting more wealth, because it has the ability to manufacture. And this starts the imbalance between the North and the South, because what the South wants is that as the North is starting to expand westward, the South wants them to make one state a slave state and the other state a free state, so to speak. Okay, so that starts the edge, because the North starts to see that they don't want that tit for tat or one for one, and, you know, they don't want that. Because, see, they're getting wealthy. The inventions are starting, you know, to one point the railroad, the steam power is coming into being. So these two things, the manufacturing and is coming into being, and therefore the North wants the West, as he goes West, they want the entire thing to be non-slave. So they are starting in the 1850s, pitched battles are starting in Kansas and Missouri. They're really fighting. I mean, they're pitched battles between those who want non-slave and those who want chattel, you see. So that starts to mushroom in the 50s, 1850s. As you move into the 60s, everything is starting to just boil. And the South sees that it has a less advantage than the North, so they figure in, you know, 1861, they're just going to fire on the North and try to get this thing over with and try to beat them before they get too much power. So that's when it starts.
At that point, was there, when you start talking about you getting into the middle 1800s, 1850, 1860, well, actually 1850, there was a law, right, abetting against the abetting of fugitive slaves, I guess even in the North. But
right.
Yet something occurred, as you're saying, in the North that did serve to be a somewhat more attractive to slaves than remaining in the southern states. Is that just simply, as you're saying, because of the industrialization of the North?
Right.
The agro of the South?
Yes, exactly. The industrialization is starting, and there's no cash crops in the North. So for the North, and they're pressured more to go towards the machinery. See, in the South, they have cash crops, so they can work the slave, get the money, send it off to England, and get the, you know, remuneration for it. But it was still being done by slave labor. So the profits were going to the heads of the plantation, but it wasn't a matter that it was not moving towards industrialization, which would bring in more money. See, in other words, industrialization, with the manufacturing of products, was more bountiful. They could make more things quicker, because with slave labor, all you were doing was getting people to knit this or knit that by hand labor. So therefore, industrialization brings a different phase of productivity. So you're getting more things done in a day. You can make wares you made 10 shoes in a week. Now you can make 100 shoes in a week. And that just keeps going and getting more and more. So naturally, the North wants more people to be wage slaves than they want them to be chattel. They don't need chattel anymore. It's useless. They want to move towards wage slavery. That's where the light is going. you see, and the north starts getting, you know, larger and larger. There's more people, and the south sees that they're losing ground, so therefore they have to strike out, and that's what happens, you know, firing on the fort in South Carolina. So.
And so that began that division?
Yes. That's the beginning of the Civil War, 1861. That's the beginning of the Civil War.
Now, was that really driven by slavery, or was it more?
No, it wasn't driven by slavery per se. It was really driven by industrialization, because industrialization, you could make more money from a machine than you could from a human. Even though you didn't even charge, you know, even though you weren't paying them a wage, you could get more from a machine than you could from a human. So you're getting 100, let's say you're getting 10 shoes or 20 shoes in a week. You can get 100 shoes in a week. Well, you want to sell those shoes. You see what I mean? And you want to sell those shoes to people who can afford to pay for them. See, so you need people who are working for some sort of wage. So wage becomes the king. See, so because it's more plentiful. So the North is growing faster than the South. And therefore, that's why the South sees that the North is expanding, and they move in to start their war because they see that they're going to be overrun. So they want to try to get this thing going, and the early times of the war, the South really is winning a lot of the contact, you know, a lot of the battles are being won by the South, because the general of the army, he kind of favors the South. He doesn't want to do too much. I forget his name right now. But they have a series of generals that Lincoln had to move to get one that really was going to punch the South out. And, of course, I didn't bring that name with me either. Awful. But anyway, it's Grant. Ulysses S. Grant, and he gets his guys with him, Sherman and Sheridan, and they're all staunchly Northern, and they want to get this thing over. So it's with them constantly, and the turning point, of course, is the battle they have in Pennsylvania. That was a turning point that I wish that would come to me now, to Gettysburg. That's the battle where the turning point comes. And I think that's about 1863 or so. All the time they're fighting, and the losses are heavy with the North, but they keep fighting, and it's at Gettysburg, and Lincoln gives that famous Gettysburg speech. But that's the turning point. From then on, they're taking the war to the South. And as they do so, they start winning the battles, because Grant is more concerted with the tactics to undermine the South. The North has many more people to use to fight than the South does, and therefore they start to take the South piece by piece. And 1865 is the final one.
Yeah, 1865.
So, 65, right.
I'm hearing that it wasn't just a matter of slavery. There was a financial piece there tied in, and I guess with the North.
Well, that's
being
what slavery was. Slavery was a financial piece. But I'm saying, you know, slavery was a financial piece, but the thing that overrode slavery was the machine, was going industrial. See, that was the thing that was nothing ever about morality. That wasn't in there at all. It was all about how we can make more money, how we can get rich, and rich beyond our greatest ideas, you know, because we now have multi-trillionaires running the country. Multi-trillionaires. Didn't say single, multi. So
yeah, well, based on labor. I mean, you know, who doesn't want to have a business where you don't have to pay for labor?
Yeah, but see, if it's just chattel and it's done by hand, it's slower. Once you have a machine, the machine can go fast, can go faster. So you get 100 people doing something, and you get 100 machines doing something, the 100 machines are going to produce much more than the 100 people can do because it's hand-driven, and the machine is mechanism. It's going over and over and over until it just wears out. But it takes a longer time for it to wear out than for the person. So the question was, what is more productive? What makes more money? You see, and of course the end all of this stuff is that capitalism is the thing that's being favored here. And capitalism is the thing that will eventually take us to our demise. But I'm summing up something that I haven't gotten to really yet.
Let me ask you, you're a reader, an avid reader.
Yeah.
Can you talk a little bit about that impact of books like Uncle Tom's Cabin, for example?
Yeah, well, that book was meaningful in the sense of trying to be, trying to be liberal. That's a classical liberal book. Have concern for your fellow man. You know, it was all crowded. It wasn't taking into consideration that it wasn't a matter of having no concern for your fellow man. It was a matter that I want to get wealth and I want to be powerful from wealth. See, that's the difference. She meant well, but that wasn't going to solve the situation because you're asking people to say don't yearn for wealth. Yearn for consideration of your fellow man. Well, that doesn't work when a person is busy getting wealthy. See, because wealthy calls the thing to have a luxurious life. You do what you know want to do. You can have all the entertainment stuff that you know is luxury. So therefore. Yeah, that was a vain effort but it still was tempered with white supremacy. See, it also was tempered with white supremacy. Have you know, be nice, be kind to those who are not your equal. See, that was the thing. Be kind and nice to those who are not your equal. It wasn't stressing equality. See. It was stressing, you know, have some kind of heart, you know, be nice, you know, you're a superior, so just be nice, that's all. But it wasn't bringing people to realize that there was no such thing as someone being superior. There's such a thing as people being more advanced than other people at given periods in history. See, it's one species, and they don't all develop, say, industrially at the same time, but that doesn't mean that one is superior to the other, you see, because as one rises, it also falls. And we see that classically with Rome, who kept extending until their productivity couldn't support their great expansion. So it all caved in and went to naught. See? And what happened to England, who ruled the seas for a number of years? The wars with Germany sunk England. So who comes on the scene is the United States. Now, its time its clock is ticking also. See, its clock is ticking. Because, see, there's not some individual grouping that is superior to the other. You see? So we're mm-hmm. one species, and we've got to try to find a way to, you know, be compassionate with each other. Because I may beat you today, but your children will someday conquer mine. See, so we think that, oh, I'm the greatest, when no, you have a time period when you're there, and that goes away. It's just like we are born and we die. That's the way it is. We are born and we die. You rise, civilizations rise and they fall. Rise and they fall. Egypt was the longest civilization to exist so far in human history. No civilization has lasted as long as Egypt. But then Egypt didn't move to using iron weapons. That became their demise. So we have all of these little things that go on, and we have to realize that none of us are superior. We're all one species, and we all have to try to come together and understand that. That's my motto. That's how I see the world. And I think it's the closest thing we can get to a truth in how to keep our species going. I don't see any other way but to be moved to a communal system. We can have all our industrialization and stuff, but we have to stop at some points from what we're going to do, how are we going to do it, because all these oil pipelines and stuff, they're going to kill us. It's going to kill us. They want this pipeline here, this pipeline there of oil, and they don't even have to use oil anymore. They can use the sun. The technology has gotten to that point. We can use the sun. And the guys want to hold on to their, you know, their multi-trillionaire. So, hey, I don't want to give up where I'm at now. I may not, you know, be able to sustain what I have. And that's why the sooner we get rid of capitalism, the better off we'll be. Because, see, the monster really is capitalism. That's the monster. See, wage slavery is the monster.
Well, it's interesting, Ron, because early on it was not wage slavery. It started out as chattel slavery simply because of the nature of the country, which was agricultural.
Right, totally agricultural.
But now the country is no longer agricultural.
Right.
It's more industrial, and it's becoming technological, which is a form, the modern-day industrious.
That's right. That's right. Right.
So there's another
transition.
Another
right.
transition in place now, and as I see it, that's why we have an educational disparity
that's right.
taking place. Oh.
Right.
The great leveler was education.
Yes.
Seems to me now that they've infiltrated a distraction, which is to take certain sects of society, such as our African-American sect, and distract them with things such as low wages, which are a reflection of less education.
Right.
And they combine that with infiltration and influence of role models, which are destructive
right.
to
right.
race at sure. at its core, which is its youth.
Yes. Yes.
And I would agree with you that the goal of all of is financially based,
mm-hmm.
because if those initiatives were not put in place, then there might be some leveling of that economic disparity. So I would
right.
say that the rationale behind those initiatives to degrade and destroy certain sections of society is because of the desire to protect their wealth.
That's right. Exactly.
So ultimately, come back to that. But the means of doing that is what I was just referring to.
Yes. Yes.
And,
you're right.
And that's when the high crime rate, the murdering of...
the high crime rate because of the great disparity of the wealth at the top and little or nothing at the bottom.
Yeah,
I mean,
because all
not,
of the education.
Yeah, I mean, right. We look at, at one time there was the Wild West, right? Gunfights between whites and whites. And then in the 30s with the Depression, we had the rise of the big mobsters, you know, Machine Gun Kelly, John Dillinger. We had all these guys and, you know, the mafia, which is still exists. So, you know, because of wealth disparity. And that's the thing. And, you know, they try to focus on black crime, street crime, but you never hear about what happens in the suites. Corporate crime, you see, corporate crime, the collapse we just had in 2007, 2008, that was done by the banks, the big banks at that. No one went to jail. I mean, you know, we have this crime going on all the time. And one guy gets put in jail, can't think of his name either, darn it. But anyway, he's serving time, but he wasn't the one, you know, the big pin. He was a little guy, really, because the big guys, they don't go to jail. They just don't. And that's why people like Edward Snowden can't come back to the country. Not because he gave important secrets. He gave the criminality of the government. He exposed the criminality of the government. Chelsea Manning, exposed the criminality of what was going on in Afghanistan and Iraq, the criminality there, shooting unarmed reporters, shooting them down in the street from helicopters. I mean, all of that stuff. And Julian Assange can't come out of the embassy, the Ecuadorian embassy in England, in London, I should say. And because they want to get him and put him in jail for exposing their own criminality. I mean, you know, we're in a very tight spot here, very tight. And we can see which way Trump is. I mean, here's a guy, I mean, for all his intelligence, he is an idiot. And I say he's an idiot not because he doesn't have some intelligence. He has some intelligence, but where it's important, he doesn't have it. Isolating five countries, Muslim countries, and saying he's making America safe, that's idiotic. He's talking against, he's locating a certain segment of countries when what he's up against is ideology. Ideology floats all over the world. People can come from all over the world and do things to America. They don't just have to come out of those five countries. There's other, even other Muslim countries they can come out of. They don't have to just be there. He, and I need not go too much into Trump because that would get us off on another spin, but I mean, he's dangerous is what I can say, because he doesn't seem to have the, sort of like a political consciousness. He, you know, he's thin-skinned, and anytime you criticize him, he has to go off on you and say things about you that has nothing to do with you personally. You know what I mean? So he, you know, he calls the actress. She's a two-weight actress, you know, that criticizes him. And, you know, the woman has got two or three Oscars for her acting ability, you know. And, well, let me shut up. I'm sorry to keep going.
Yeah, we're getting off
traveling on.
I prefer not to give that any energy. What I want to talk about is some of the pertinent points in history. Emancipation, formation, what kind of impact do you see that had? What role was that significant?
Well, see, the emancipation, the proclamation of emancipation, or emancipation proclamation, I'll put it that way, was to free up the slaves. They realized that they couldn't keep the slavery in the South if they wanted to go west and have it all unslaved. So as a result of losing the war, the South losing the war, they wanted to just banish slavery altogether so that there wouldn't be any you get this state free and that state's not free. They didn't want to be bothered with that stuff. They wanted everything to be open to wage slavery. So that's ended that once the war was over. However, in order to appease the South, they came up with the fact of pulling the troops out of the South so that the South could have the authority of the South then without trying to be equal with the equal for its population, see. So that's the way they took the anger of losing the war out on the blacks, see. So that's when this lynching started, you know, from 1865 moving forth to, 1865 to 1867 to 1876 was the period of the period of Reconstruction. Yes, that's when blacks were getting to be in the Congress, Senate, and stuff like that. So they had to get rid of that. So as of that compromise that came in 1876 with the presidential thing, because there was a tie with the presidential elections. So they came to the point of agreeing to pull the troops out of the South and get a Northern put in as the president rather than a Southerner, because there was a tie between a Southern person and the Northern person. So, therefore, when they pull the troops out, that's when the Klan moved in, see, to pay the blacks back for, you know, raising and being, thinking of themselves as being equal. So they had to, you know, put the blacks down, and one of the ways to put them down was to make them poor, see, make them poor, and that's how Jim Crow comes into being.
But isn't that where the fear factor also came in?
Yeah, well, making them poor, yeah, sure. That's the oppression. They come in and they, if you're not doing what they want done, they burn a cross on your house, on your property and stuff like that. Yeah, and actually, if you're, you know, trying to be independent and not following, they lynch you. Yeah, I mean, that's when the 100 years of lynching starts. And, you know, so, and the North looks the other way because right into the point of Roosevelt, he would have nothing to do with signing on to a anti-lynching bill. They tried to get a anti-lynching bill passed through several presidents. I remember, let's see, who's the guy? He was a Southerner in the First World War. I can't think of his name right now, but anyway, he wouldn't sign on. He was because he was a Southerner, really, and I can't think of his name, but that he was the president that took us into war because they were trying to stay out of it, but finally, financial connections between England and the United States were so tied, and I think the guy who was had his feet in both countries happened to be this great banker, J.P. Morgan. That's the big guy, J.P. Morgan, yes. He had his feet in both sides, so he brought the country over into going on the side of England. And that's how they threw off England in the First World War, by the American troops coming in and overpowering the Germans at that point. Because they were just... Yeah, go ahead.
Ron, back to some of the pertinent time points or some of the pertinent points along the timeline.
Yes.
We talked about the Emancipation Proclamation and
yes.
The backlash behind that, which was basically the lynching. You spoke of a 100-year lynching, or I forget the term that you've used.
Yeah, that's the term because it wasn't
that 100
exactly, but, you know, the lynching continued, you know, from... right into the 30s, right into the 1930s and 40s in the South.
What were the time frame? Was it like 1865 to the early 1930s?
Well, it was, let's say, 1876 when the troops were pulled out of the South. They were pulled out as that part of a bargain with having a Republican president, as opposed to a fellow that was from the South. And they made that agreement to pull out the troops from the South. And, of course, once they did that, you know, all hell broke loose because the whites in the South were wanting to teach the blacks a lesson of they're not equal, you see. So that was going to make
the
blacks... Go ahead.
That was post the Emancipation Proclamation.
The Emancipation Proclamation freed all the Southern slaves, or all the
Correct.
Slaves, wherever they were, really.
That was in, what, 1863
is when Lincoln signs that, you know, that proclamation. But of course, it doesn't start right then and there because the war is still going on.
And what time frame were the troops pulled out?
The time frame of the troops were pulled out in thought to be pulled out in 1876.
Right.
That's between 1865 and 1876 is the Reconstruction period when they started building colleges for they also started building colleges for blacks in that Reconstruction period also. Because that's, you know, what Reconstruction is about, trying to bring blacks into our system. And, of course, the North wanted to bring blacks into the system, not equal, but bring them into being literate because that was necessary for an industrial society to be literate.
So back to when they were pulling the troops out en masse.
Right.
That was in the late 1800s,
1870s? That's starting in 1876.
Post-Reconstruction.
Right.
Which began the massive lynching. But I guess the point that I was making was, wasn't there lynching even prior to that?
Prior to that, to have blacks...
there was lynching prior to that, wasn't there?
Well, of course, there were attempts by the South to, have the troops moved out. But, of course, the North had won the war, so they didn't feel, that they had to do it. But as a point of 1876, there was another thing that was on the minds of the North, too, and that was a deep recession that set in. And this deep recession had set in, and that was another point that they wanted to start to generate, more business. So I guess they felt that also if they kind of tried to regard the South, respect the whites in the South, they could move some of their manufacturing into the South also, to start production there. So there was also, always an economic thing going on at the same time.
Well, speaking of time points again, post-Reconstruction, that same time period, I find this interesting when you were calling it sort of that 100-year lynching period, a post-Reconstruction, also was when Jim Crow was in effect, correct?
Correct, sure.
All the way up until
that is Jim Crow. From 1876 forward is Jim Crow. And I mean,
right.
It really came right up into the North. The Jim Crow came right on up into the North. Because, in the 40s, the department stores didn't hire black clerks in the stores. They hired you... Right here in New York, they hired you as a janitor, but you could never be a clerk right here in New York City.
Right.
And it was Adam Clayton Powell that got that changed. That was his contribution. He got that changed so that people would be able to work as clerks in department stores right here. And there were a lot of race riots in the North, too, as people were, moving here from the South. And because, it was a matter of as blacks moved to the South, they wanted jobs. And, there's only a certain amount of jobs that are needed, And for the type of economy that we have, we must have a population of unemployed people at all times. There's got to be, because that's the way wages are kept low. If you have just enough if you have just enough people to work on your jobs, wages will start to rise because they'll see someone will say, I want X amount more, and if I don't get it here, I can get it across the street, or I can get it down the block, whatever. So there's something built into capitalism that demands that there's always an army of people who are unemployed. That's necessary. See?
Correct.
And in spite of that, there's always booms and busts. Booms and busts. Booms and busts. It's very unstable, a very unstable economic system. And if it didn't produce super wealthy people, it would have been eliminated years ago.
Well, that's an excellent point that maybe we can pick up on in a future part of this, because we've brought it all the way up from, you know, the Middle Passage,
yeah,
if you will, up through indentured servitude, chattel slavery, up through the industrial age, and of course the emancipation, well, the Civil War, and the Emancipation Proclamation, the 100 lynchings, Reconstruction, Jim Crow, Civil Rights Movement. So we've kind of brought it up, and I don't know if folks realize that you said 1865 Jim Crow was basically abolished. That isn't a whole hell of a long time ago.
And
so, you know, that's in our lifetime, of course.
Right.
I was 10.
And Jim Crow is still here. When a cop kills a innocent black person and walks free, what is that but Jim Crow? That's a lynching.
Exactly. That's a modern day lynching.
Right.
And that's where I'd like to pick up in the next segment of this, Ron. This has been an excellent journey you've taken us on.
Thank you. I wish I could get more into it. But what you're saying is pushing me that I've got to write this stuff down. I got to do that.
The book is waiting. We're waiting for the book. Serious, but it doesn't have to be a novel, because what you're going to do,
be a pamphlet even.
You're going to have to give us more than a pamphlet, Ron.
Okay.
But
okay.
Give us at least a paperback.
Okay.
But the way that you outline it is very unique. I think it's something that deserves to be put in text.
Yeah.
And I'm looking forward to picking up from that point of, you know, the end of Jim Crow, all the way through the civil rights, and talk about now what took place from there to bring us where we are now. Modern day Jim Crow, a modern day industrial slavery, wage slavery, as you call it. And that's where I like to pick up. That's okay, in the next segment of this.
Okay.
Because this is lightning.
Yes.
In lightning.
Slavery.
Yeah. That's exactly what it is.
That way, but that's what it really is. Because you bring on unions, but they also break unions too.
You
see what I mean? I mean, when the auto industry started moving out of here, the unions were flat-footed. They couldn't do a thing. It's based on the private ownership of property. See, the private ownership of property and the private ownership of production. The boss determines that.
That's true.
No union can determine that.
Well, you know, and we can get in, and we can't help but get into some of that when we get into the next phase, because we're talking, at that point, I believe we're talking truly about the capitalistic aspect of what's
absolutely
going on. We, the current,
what, yes,
have to bear down on that.
Right.
Because that's what it is today.
Right, and that's from the start. From the start of this country, capitalism had its what should I say, its fangs buried into this country.
And,
because
and
it just makes a see, it just makes a turn from feudalism into capitalism, or they say feudalism into mercantilism, and from mercantilism into capitalism. Those are the three points.
Say that again.
Feudalism, the kings and the queens, feudalism into mercantilism. Mercantilism is when they go, the Europeans finally go to Eastern or Western countries that are underdeveloped, according to, you know, industrialization, and the king allots a certain property to a high official, you know, in the that comes over to that country to have ownership of a given area, say like in India or something like that, where in India the British destroyed the cotton weaving industry of India, so that it all has to be centered in England. You see, that's how they get wealthy, taking things from others and making it theirs and cutting out the person, the country that is less powerful than they are. So this is, now we get into, we'll eventually go into imperialism, because that's the first cousin of capitalism. That's its first cousin, or maybe I should even say its brother. And sister.
Brother, that's the word I
yeah,
was
Yeah, brother at. And sister, that's what I should say. Not cousin, brother and sister. Because you can't have capitalism successful unless you do have imperialism.
Yeah. Yeah, that's exactly what I was talking about, yeah.
Okay, good.
Let's go next time, and the idea is that, you know, we can open up the minds and the eyes of, you know, our brothers and sisters, so that we can at least, at a minimum, be aware, because there's nothing that can be done if we're not aware. We wouldn't
right.
have had a civil rights movement if there was no awareness.
Of course. Right.
So, yeah.
And
the country
calls itself a democracy. The country, at best, is an oligarchy. At best. When you can talk about people with trillions of dollars, you have to realize it's an oligarchy and not a democracy. They say democracy for the wealthy, but it's not really. For the guys on top, it's their dictatorship. And that's what an oligarchy is. Corporate ownership of the means of production.
Yeah, as I was studying, I always questioned that. I go all the way back, you know, decades.
Right.
I was in college in my economic classes, and I used to always say, well, from what I'm seeing, and that was back then, you know, that's homework for our listeners. Look up that word, oligarchy.
Imperialism?
And imperialism. Those are the two homework for next week, listeners. And let's come back and have some constructive dialogue with our next week's guest. But, Ron, before this month is out, I want to pick up on this dialogue that we've had. Certainly has been enlightening. You've certainly opened our eyes. And with that, I thank you. For those who tuned in late, you have to go to the archives to catch this entire program. We have been talking today with Mr. Ronald Crenshaw, who is a civil rights advocate, a political activist, historian, research analyst, and truly a crusader for the rights of all. And we thank you for joining us again on this edition of Progressive News Weekly, and I look forward to you.
And I want to include a little tidbit next time on black nationalism, okay? Because I think it needs some correction, too. I really do.
All right. I'm just making
right.
a note of that. I'm
okay.
just making a note of nationalism.
Okay. Yeah, black
nationalism. On that one. I've highlighted it and underscored it.
Okay.
So we will be talking next time about that as we segue from
okay.
the civil rights movement all the way up until today. Thank you again to our listeners.
Thank you,
Ron, for opening our eyes. We appreciate that. Our listeners, we thank you, because we certainly could not have done this today, or we wouldn't be here if it weren't for you. So continue listening. Tell someone about Progressive News Weekly. Listen to the archives. To go to the archives, you'll just simply go to your computer, and you'll go to the site, blogtalkradio.com/Renford, R-E-N-F-O-R-D, and you'll get to that site, and you'll look and see all the different programs on this network, and you'll find Daryl Clark's Progressive News Weekly. It's listed by date and topic, and you'll see Daryl Clark with special guest Ronald Crenshaw. And tune in, and believe me, you'll find something in there that you didn't catch. Thank you again, Ron.
Thank you
Bye.
For having me. Bye-bye. That I beg you see and breathe, oh yeah, and master, yeah, see, yeah, only open our eyes, open our eyes, open our eyes.